Welcome to the 2018 Bay Area Book Festival. This is Sherilyn Parsons, founder and director of the festival. Enjoy the conversation.
Welcome, everybody. I'm Joe DiPrisco. I'm the chair of the Simpson Family Literary Project. And this is the panel which will be discussing how stories make the world. There is a joint sponsorship for this panel. UC Berkeley Arts and Design is one sponsor. It's the campus-wide initiative led by Shannon Jackson, Associate Vice Chancellor for the Arts and Design. And theirs is an initiative that seeks to feature and fortify our creative campus and to provide a ready vehicle for community partnership and public engagement, like with the Bay Area Festival of Books. And the Simpson Family Literary Project is in its third year of operations. We support writing workshops taught at Contra Costa County Juvenile Hall, at Northgate High School, and at Girls Inc. in downtown Oakland, and the Writer in Residence Program at the Lafayette Library, and the $50,000 yearly award to a mid-career author of fiction. So, that's us. No applications will be taken today. Although we probably could get some pretty good applications if we did. All right, so let me introduce our distinguished panel. If I took the time to list every award and honor of everybody at this table, we would not get started till noon. So I'm not going to do that. It's going to be a very brief introduction. So over there we have Scott Saul, an Americanist, professor at UC Berkeley, author of a wonderful book, Becoming Richard Pryor. He'll be joining us to talk about everything. And then we have Ishmael Muhammad, who's a Simpson Fellow, teaching at Contra Costa County Juvenile Hall. He's a terrific critic, published in the Paris Review. Well, I won't list all his publications, but well worth reading. And then we have Anthony Mara, who was just named the second Simpson Prize winner, has an armload of prizes to his credit, author of A Constellation of Vital Phenomena, and The Tsar of Love and Techno. And then, this is someone you might recognize, Joyce Carol Oates, a giant in our world. And I'm not even gonna try to suggest what Joyce has done. All right, so my plan as moderator, thank you all for joining us. My plan as moderator is to ask a few questions and get out of the way of our speakers, and I hope that they will engage each other in these questions and in the answers that they live by as writers and teachers. And here we are, writers of different generations, races, and cultural backgrounds, and I'm pretty confident that the differences that we are sensitive to in our conversation will be instructive for everybody. Unless I totally mess this up, this conversation, which there's a good chance I'll do. All right, so the Simpson Literary Project has a mantra. You need one of those. And our mantra is, storytelling is the foundation of a literate society. So here you are, Joyce, who's on our project committee, Scott's on our project committee, Ishmael, who's a Simpson Fellow, and Tony, who just won the Simpson Prize. I would love to get your reactions, your responses to that mantra, storytelling is the foundation of a literate society. Who wants to go first, Scott?
I actually brought here a little quote from Walter Benjamin, who has a great essay called The Storyteller. It's about the threat to storytelling and how endangered it is. He wrote, "The art of storytelling is coming to an end. Less and less frequently do we encounter people with the ability to tell a tale properly." And here you might think about when you go to a cafe and you see a group of four people and each of them is on their phones, not telling stories. More and more often there is embarrassment all around when the wish to hear a story is expressed. It is as if something that seemed inalienable to us, the securest among our possessions, were taken from us. The ability to exchange experiences. One reason for this phenomenon is obvious. experience has fallen in value, and it looks as if it's continuing to fall into bottomlessness. Walter Benjamin wrote that in the aftermath of World War I. And so the question is that, does that, and was that true then? Does this analysis still pertain? I personally think that we live in a world that's full of information. That was Walter Benjamin's analysis as well, where information streams into us and we live in this media unlimited society. And I think that there's a difference between information, processing information, which we become very good at, like human computers, and the ability to craft a story and to inhabit experience and to try to reach out to other people's experience. So start there.
Okay.
Well, just to respond to that, it's an interesting quote, but if it had been uttered at the end of World War I, it's the very cusp of the great modernist 20th century. I mean, look at the brilliant work that's coming in poetry, art, music, everything. I mean, I'm just not sure how relevant, though the quote in itself is provocative and interesting. Historically, it seems to have been mistaken. And also the storytelling, say, of Nazi Germany, that's a kind of malicious storytelling. We would say totally fiction. The Aryan cosmology is totally fictitious. But it is a storytelling that many people believe in. So just to respond to that.
Yeah, but again, literacy and literature, people make a distinction here. I wonder if, Ishmael, you're teaching at the Contra Costa County Juvie. Do you feel that literature and literacy are a unified goal?
Can you repeat the question for me?
No, I can't, actually. But I'll make up another one. So people make a distinction. Well, if you want to promote literacy, it's not about storytelling. Storytelling is an advanced form of literacy. And one of the underlying assumptions of the project is, well, one way that kids become literate is by telling their stories. I mean, Joyce has a wonderful story about becoming a writer before she knew how to write. Before she knew words, she was writing stories. I don't even know what that means, but I believe it. So. Scribbling, okay, chickens and stuff, okay. So, Ishmael.
So I just had my first session at this juvenile detention facility last Tuesday.
Can you all hear Ishmael back there?
Yeah, can you guys hear me?
Yeah.
And what struck me was that, I don't know what these kids' lives are like at all. I have not had their experiences at all. And so I'm letting them kind of guide me through what they want the class to be, the workshop to be at this point. And one of the first things they did was ask me to show a music video to a Bay Area rap artist named Mozzy, who I had never heard of. I'd never heard of this song before, but I was open to watching the video and letting them explain to me, like, what about this song seemed to reflect their world. And one of the students, after we watched it, ended up making a connection between that video and a poem we had read that day. It's Dennis Smith's Alternate Names for Black Boys. It's a gorgeous poem, kind of written in the wake of Black Lives Matter. And it just struck me that you asked if like literature and literacy are kind of working towards a unified goal, and we should be careful about what we think about as being literature. Right, what forms of media or storytelling help encourage literacy in youth, in what ways they actually see their stories being told in the public. So I wonder if we can like broaden our ideas of what literature can be. I can't help but remark that Kendrick Lamar just won the Pulitzer Prize for music. Was it a few weeks ago?
Ishmael has a great piece about that in Slate.
It's in Slate. Came out last week. Yeah. Read it.
Yeah, I think for me, there was a priest who told me when I was a kid that compassion is the ability to see someone else's suffering in you and to see your suffering in someone else. And I think that storytelling is is the means of sort of transmitting that information. And I think for me the goal of literature or one of its aims besides the the pure aesthetic experience is this question of sort of making a more just and humane space for people to encounter one another, and that to me is sort of the endpoint of literature, to create these places where books serve almost as tunnels that can drop you through the center of the earth, and you can emerge besides people you would never otherwise meet and recognize yourself in them.
Well, following up here, not to go to writer conferences, Squaw Valley or Breadloaf or something, but so Joy Williams said something the other day that I found interesting. She said, the work of a writer is to keep the story from becoming what it is about. And it made me think of Vivian Gornick's terrific book, The Situation and the Story. I don't know if you guys are familiar with that brilliant, brilliant book. But I'm wondering, does that kind of reading resonate for you as teachers or as writers? That is, that your job as a writer is to keep the story from being what it is about and to be the story.
Well,
probably not, but I gave it my best shot.
No, I'll speak to you as a biographer.
Yes.
You notice there's a lot of biographies that are extremely long, and sometimes they seem to suffer from an excess of information that hasn't been digested into a story, and that's a problem. I think that a lot of great biographies, you see that they have a little preface that's like 5 to 10 pages, where they basically say, oh, this is kind of what it's about. And they establish that, but then after that, you just get immersed in the story. And so anyway, the argument that the biographer is making about the person's life is threaded through the story. And I think those are the biographies that live, that where you feel like this, you're seeing the character of the person whose biography you're reading come alive, and you see it from different angles. You see who they might have become, who they didn't become, how their relationship shaped them. And I think that's what gives those biographies that kind of beating heart, that as opposed to just being a mass of information.
And that's where footnotes are for. I mean, you have
100
pages
footnotes.
Of footnotes,
like,
and,
I love the footnotes.
And Becoming Richard Pryor. So,
this question of what a story is about. I think that is often something that the reader of a book almost brings to it more than the writer. That I think. I'd be fascinated to hear your experiences with it, Joyce. But I often feel that the book's sort of controlling themes and the sort of philosophical or political or those sort of cultural textures that a book ultimately becomes about only sort of emerges well into the process of writing, or even in the final stages, and that if you go into a project thinking, I'm going to make an argument about this in the manner that you would with an essay, the novel feels essayistic and perhaps slightly inert and losing that kind of wonderful wonderful realness that a good piece of fiction, I think, provides.
Yes, well, a lot. We can think of literature as sort of along a spectrum. At one extreme, you have works that seem very objective, and they're maybe filled with history and with research, and the world is very vividly presented. So, this may be very commercially successful fiction. There are novels that take us to places, like travelogues. And if you read them carefully and immerse yourself in them, it's really almost as if you are there. So there's a high degree of what it's about, a high degree of information. As you move along the spectrum, you come into different kinds of voices and different sorts of perspectives, especially in the 20th century, which is a very experimental century. Right now we have storytelling that would almost be incomprehensible to our ancestors. We have wonderfully radical, idiosyncratic, first-person monologues that may be published in the New Yorker, for instance. Stories like that are utterances that are very unique and sometimes very funny. Some of them are like stand-up comedy, because that's another genre of our era, like rap music. These are all expressions of the human, you know, human creativity. And as you move along in that direction, the degree of information or what it's about gets smaller and smaller, because it's more and more about a person, about a voice, about maybe a really wonderful voice. Or it could be an obnoxious, annoying voice, but still you love to hate that voice, you know. So this, the idea of the writer as performer or presenter, in contrast with, as I said at the beginning, the different kind of novel that's very believable and honest, the sort of honest novel compendium of history and facts, in contrast with more experimental work, instead of moving through the middle, novels like the great novels of William Faulkner, which are not immediately accessible to many readers, and back in, you know, in the 18th or 19th century would have been maybe incoherent and unintelligible. But now we can read those novels, especially if we've gone to UC Berkeley and studied in an English department. But you do need a kind of training to get into this more experimental work. So that's what Joy Williams meant. Joy Williams herself is a very experimental and sort of weirdly wonderful writer whom many people could read and say, well, what was that about?
I want to quote something that T. Geronimo Johnson wrote. Geronimo was the 2017 Simpson Prize winner, Tony's successor. And he wrote, "In more recent years, American writers have written boldly across divides of class, age, ethnic identity, and gender. We must trust the human imagination, its predilection for digging at the roots of things, for prying at what is fixed. We must hesitate to suggest boundaries and perimeters. Let us strive to dissolve borders." So my question for my distinguished panel is, so specifically when it comes to race and ethnicity, topics you've all addressed in various ways, does Geronimo's takeaway mean something to you about borders?
I think I'm hesitant to valorize the idea of like dissolving borders. I sympathize with the notion that we want to kind of collapse the distance between like various racial or ethnic or religious or gender identities, right? And kind of as Anthony said, like drop ourselves beside people whom we don't understand initially. But I wonder if there's like a better metaphor for that experience than dissolving borders between us. Because does that mean, or implicit in that metaphor, at least to me, is the idea of kind of dissolving identity. Something about that just doesn't appeal to me. I think of Du Bois and in Souls of Black Folk, he talks about unity and alterity, which is a great metaphor for me for what it means to be American, to kind of like think about literature in the American context. The idea that you can be a single people or kind of think about one another's experiences while maintaining space for that difference or that alterity. And I don't think that necessitates dissolving borders between us necessarily. The borders are what help us recognize and think about each other's differences and therefore hopefully like become more empathetic, more understanding.
Well, what are the challenges representing race and ethnicity these days, then? What are the metaphors that the rest of you would use?
Well, I just speak as a biographer trying to write the story of Richard Pryor. You know, and he grew up in a brothel in Peoria, Illinois, and I grew up in the suburbia of San Fernando Valley in the 70s, very different. And, you know, some people would say, although actually, interestingly enough, his daughter lived like a block down from me when I was like 0 to 10 years old. I had no idea. Anyway, and actually there was a lot of craziness going on just a block away from me in that world. but I didn't see it. But my point, I was thinking there is other people who wrote about Pryor who would just, in the middle of the biography, they would just be in his head. And they'd be like, in the experience, it's a way to like animate the biography and give it a real sense of life. And I was like, wait, there's no footnotes here. How do they actually know this? And I felt like unless I had, for a biographer, this is very different from the practice of a fiction writer thing. Like, I didn't want to presume to be able to get into his head. I wanted to interview people who knew him to reconstruct their sense of certain encounters or if I had his own writing. But I actually was, I tried to be judicious about that boundary. On the other hand, I wouldn't have invested 8 years of my life if I didn't actually really want to understand his own experience and try to recapture it for people. And I think to answer the question about the dissolving of borders, I feel like we should throw ourselves into trying to understand other people's experience. We should also be willing to do the work that is required. It's not like you can just sit in your easy chair and suddenly you're there. That's part of it. But it also, I think there is, you can't just, like, by fiat, be there. And I don't want to denigrate the power of the imagination, which is so awesome, especially amongst the people who are on this panel. But I do think it's a challenge, rather than just a, you know, open invitation.
Well, this goes to a point that you were making, Ishmael, about how perhaps storytelling or teaching storytelling is all about introducing the defamiliarization of the world, and that our students are helped. It assists them to have their world defamiliarized before their very eyes through storytelling. Did I get what you said? No, probably not.
No, I mean,
would anybody else like to do this panel here?
You're doing a great job. No, I do think that to me, as somebody who's like currently teaching a creative writing workshop and as a writer, that seems to be the chief value of storytelling, is that it makes our world unfamiliar to us, right? And it takes received narratives or preconceived notions and distorts them somewhat into shapes that we might vaguely recognize. It forces us to rethink how we move through the world, how we think about other people, how we pursue knowledge. And that's what I'm trying to convey to my students in the juvenile detention facility now, because these are kids or youth who've had many narratives attached to them in their bodies, and probably can see their lives as being somewhat constricted and predetermined, and I want them to be able to read and write to break out of those constrictions.
So I look across, following up on that, I mean, Sky's written a terrific book about Richard Pryor, getting into his head to whatever extent that's true. Ishmael's written very memorably about James Baldwin, about Cornel West and his battle with Ta-Nehisi Coates. Tony has dealt with Chechnyans, and as he said recently, no publisher in New York was looking for the next great novel relating to Chechnya. So he provided two, and so you've dealt with issues of ethnicity and of a very radical sort. And Joyce, you've dealt with these issues of alterity. Dramatically. I mean, even in the most recent, the prize-winning book of the LA Times, The Book of American Martyrs, where you open up the world of both sides or the multiple sides of the abortion debate. So, what do we do with that? I guess, you started this. You guys wrote the book.
Can I follow up on your question, Joe, for Joyce and Tony? I'm always questioning, like, how do writers choose the point of view that they'll use, and with you both have do remarkable things, shifting point of view. Joyce, I think about your story about Robert Frost, those parts from Harper's, got a little controversy, but that's good. Where it begins through the first person perspective of a woman visiting Robert Frost, but in the last part, we're in the third person, Tony, you do a lot of things with different points of view. Right now I'm reading a great new novel by Julian Barnes. You guys should all read it, but it's called The One Story, and the first section is written from the first-person point of view. And there's section two, written from the second-person point of view. Section three, written from the third-person point of view. Check it out. When does one decide that you need a different kind of focalization? Is that part of the plan when you start, or is it kind of, it emerges as you, from organically writing a story, you realize, I need to shift things around? How do you come to those decisions?
Well, I think that it depends upon what sort of novel you're undertaking. If it's somewhat experimental, then I think you're free to move around easily and without any apology to Henry James or anyone like that, to move from different perspectives, following the arc of the story. Like, where does the story, it's like a light illumination here, the story is moving along and you want to be there. But if it's maybe a more conventional or traditional work of fiction, you would probably stay with one point of view. Julian Barnes is an experimental writer. He's a great modernist writer. And so that's very playful and Nabokovian. That's what he's doing, and that really appeals to me because I'm a formalist, essentially.
Yeah, I think for me at least, I feel like I usually spend most of the book, most of the writing process, trying to figure out what that point of view is. With my first novel, A Constellation of Vital Phenomena, it took me four drafts to sort of stumble into this omniscient perspective. And it makes me think of the quote that you started off with. It seems like around that same time, shortly after World War I, we sort of abandoned omniscience as a viable and honest form of narration, that God is dead and we shouldn't trust any authority that has that kind of that seemingly false sense of knowledge and omnipotence. And I think over the last maybe 10, 20, 25 years, omniscience has maybe come to the fore once again, and it's a form of narration that that I personally am drawn to and have used in both of my books. And it seems in the same way that omniscience may have captured the perspective of a social of societies in which God was omniscient, we now live in a world where we are all omniscient. We all have little machines in our pockets that can find any amount of information from any source at any time in any place. And there's something about this seemingly antiquated mode of storytelling that actually feels incredibly prescient and feels very well suited to our current era.
But the 21st century use of omniscience is very different from the traditional, because you have this playful point of view. And Cormac McCarthy, for instance, has a very ironic, sort of almost biblical omniscient point of view. And Tony, maybe a little Nabokovian, where there's this little spin of irony that tempers the tenderness and the horror and sympathy we might feel for our characters is sort of tempered by a little bit of dissonance and a little bit of distance. But Dickens had the same sort of freewheeling, slightly comic, ironic, omniscient point of view. I think that it's very bold and original, and I usually warn students not to try to do that, because as you said, it took you four drafts. You have to have a tone that's Olympian, but not sarcastic or superior seeming. You have to be able to suggest some sympathy, but not sentimentality. Whereas if you're writing from the first person point of view, you don't have to think about any of those things. You basically have your voice. Great novels of all kinds have been written from the first person point of view. Thinking of Huckleberry Finn, for instance, maybe that's our greatest novel from that point of view. I'm sort of blanking out on some other examples. Oh, Harper Lee, mm-hmm. To Kill a Mockingbird, that's another good example. I'm thinking sort of a young adult novels that pass for adult novels, and those two, Huckleberry Finn and To Kill a Mockingbird, would be in that category.
So what about the new voices and the new cultures that are entering into the literary conversation? How have they changed the way we tell and listen to stories? And are you encouraged by prevailing trends in publishing, reviewing, and writing? Any examples come to mind about books that are novels, stories that are written these days that could never have been written 30 years ago, and lead the way to a new kind of dialogue in the literary world and beyond?
I think probably like not the best, but the most entertaining book and the most affecting book I've read in the last 5 years has been Ya Jesse's Homegoing. I'm sure many of you have read it. Just because it accomplishes something that I've never seen done in contemporary African-American literature, which is just to try to create this massive fictional artifice of like a black diasporic history that like begins in one place and ends in America, which is not something that most African-Americans can claim. Like nobody really knows who their ancestors are in West Africa. So it's definitely a work of a fantasy. There's something fantastical about it, and there's something fantastical in even the idea of wanting to figure out what your origins are on the other side of the Atlantic. But I think it's like a great work of a fiction and an interesting kind of intervention into how we think about black history. And I can't imagine that being done like 30 years ago.
I've been really taken recently with novels that try to address technological changes. Particularly, we were talking yesterday. I've been talking to everyone. I've been a broken record on it. But there's a new book by Richard Powers called The Overstory, which is one of the most profound books I've read in a very long time, in which he basically it's a novel about trees, and he addresses in interviews and within the book he talks about how traditionally American literature has been focused on psychological conflicts. And then every now and then, books will step into the conflicts between sort of conflicts with society. But that very rarely do books venture into environmental conflict, sort of the largest kind of conflict that a human can be part of, and that this is this incredible gap in our literature that we're not addressing, even as the evidence of climate change is abundant and rampant, that fiction doesn't address or rarely addresses, seems unsuited to address these large scale environmental environmental conflicts, because it moves at a pace that that few individual people can really comprehend and hold in their head the way we can much more intimate conflicts between characters. And I feel like that book is The Overstory is just revolutionary in terms of making environmental conflict the center of a book above all of the messy drama of human hearts, and to pull it off in a way that makes you care about trees even more than the characters who are obsessed with them, I think is a real triumph.
Well, there's a novel I have not read in a while by Barbara Godey called, I think, White Bone, and that's about a family of elephants. And when I mention it to people, their eyes sort of glaze over, like they don't really want to read a novel about a family of elephants. I found it such a profound and deeply moving novel. I'm sitting here yearning to reread it, but I have to wait till I get back home to Princeton to read it. So maybe that's a little bit like this, though the family of elephants is concerned with how to survive. And of course, terrible things happen to some of the elements you get to care about. So in a way, it replicates some of the human drama. This novel by Richard Powers, I understand, is about like overarching trees, like over a house, a family house.
So the book itself is, and this sounds ridiculous, but it's structured like a tree. So it begins with this section called Roots that has the various backstories of these characters, then the trunk where their stories all collide, and then the crest where they culminate in the seeds, sort of telling their the aftermath of their lives. But
how long is it?
It's about 500 pages, I think. It's long, but it's the main characters are really trees in a way that. Seems impossible to do, and that I think decades ago, even a few years ago, you wouldn't the science simply wasn't there in enough abundance to really pull it off.
It's just to respond to Joe's original question about storytelling and what are the seeds that are up. I think about Hamilton, you know, and that's the song, you know, "Who Lives, Who Dies, Who Tells Your Story," as spoken by Eliza. Who Hamilton, you know, who's like, we don't have the fragments of her past. And I think that's a question that a lot of young people who love Hamilton, especially a lot of young women, young girls who love it, they're taking this question on for themselves. There's such an efflorescence of young adult literature out there that I think is much more experimental than and wide-ranging than it's been in the past. So many young readers who are thinking, yeah, who's gonna tell my story, you know? And I think this is a wonderful sign, and I think the national story is getting rewritten through Hamilton, or a wonderful play that is coming back to Cal Shakes. So people should go see it, called Black Odyssey.
It's a great play.
Which retells the story of the Odyssey from the point of view of a black veteran of the Afghanistan War. Incredible. And I think that we are in a wonderful moment of storytelling, as well as a horrible moment of national politics. Mm-hmm. And we need these stories to help, you know, bring people together.
Right. I'm very involved with Cal Shakes, and it's the funniest scene ever played by a car. There's a great car scene. Right? Do I have it right? Yeah, it's amazing. Well, okay, you brought up Hamilton, so we've been talking about literary storytelling, but what are your thoughts about other kinds of storytelling? The movies, Hamilton, the theater, TV. How's this kind of storytelling connecting differently or similarly to our literary fictions? Really want to know, what are your favorite TV shows? And I don't want an answer. I do want an answer.
Well, I just want to amplify Joe's excellent question by saying about 2 weeks ago, Angela Davis gave a presentation on campus, and she said something that was so powerful and it really sort of brought tears to my eyes. She said, I think she was being interviewed on stage, and she was asked about social justice and how activists, you know, should act and so forth. She said, sometimes I think that the artist does the most important work in advancing the cause of social justice by making us feel before we know what we have said, by making us feel something that we then will say. I thought that was so beautiful. And so that applies to all these different genres, whether it's television, film, music, literature.
What's your favorite TV show, Joyce?
I'm not sure I have a favorite. My husband and I watch series, like we were watching The Americans, which I thought was very powerfully done, and then shaping into be a tragedy as it unfolds.
Is she going to turn the daughter?
Well, I think it's a tragedy of misplaced idealism, and in the beginning we sort of went along with it, a little like Breaking Bad, where the protagonist starts off somewhat sympathetically, quite sympathetically, and then as it evolves, becomes more and more like a monster, so slowly that she doesn't seem to understand, and maybe some viewers don't quite understand how that could happen, turn into a monster.
And Tony, I know you spend some time in LA. Yeah, so give it up.
Well, what I was thinking when you asked the question was how was if you read anything by Dostoevsky, you can tell that he's never seen a TV show before, right? Like imagine trying to adapt a chapter of Dostoevsky. And kind of, you know, back to one of your earlier comments of books that are written today that couldn't have been written earlier. I think probably a lot of the narrative styles that we've become accustomed to now in novels are owe a good deal to movies. The fact that the present tense has become a pretty popular tense to narrate in compared to, say, 100 years ago, seems to be in no small part drawn from the way that we experience film. The fact that, you know, we talk about scenes within chapters, the fact that, you know, so much pressure now is put on there's a readerly expectation to have novels that are largely composed of scenes in a way that say Dostoevsky, his work has less scenes, more sort of 10-page monologues. But in terms of works that I've been particularly drawn to, I think that movies are pretty. Not all movies, but I think generally speaking, TV is a much more exciting place now than the movie theater. That it used to be that, you know, a movie that the novel was sort of the almost this uber art form where you could do more in a novel than you could in you know a 90 minute or 2 hour film. But now with these television shows that run for 6 or 7 seasons, it dwarfs what a novel is capable of purely in terms of narrative reach. And I think you see that. I recently watched Babylon Berlin, which is this sort of crazy take on Weimar, Weimar Germany. And it would have taken, you know, a 3,000-page book to fit what they managed to do over the course of a couple seasons in there, and just the scope of some of those projects, even when they go a bit haywire, I think is pretty magnificent.
So you're not watching This Is Us or Roseanne?
I don't have a TV. I only have a computer, so it has to go to Netflix first.
All right, come on. Favorite TV shows, or give a smarter answer than that.
I think I've always been struck at, I think, the reasons why I watch TV. I watch television and film for very different reasons than I like read a book. Like I want literature to kind of pull my world apart and make me question my identity and the way the world is structured, right? I watch TV shows because I want them I want to see my experience reflected on the screen. So in that sense, like a TV show like Insecure, like I love it. I'm from Los Angeles. I'm from South Central, so I watch Insecure, and I'm like, those are black people, and that's my hometown. That makes me feel good. I don't often feel that with literature, or when I do get that with literature, I feel suspicious immediately. Mm-hmm. If I read a book that perfectly reflects my experience, I'm going to throw it across the room immediately.
How'd they find that stuff out?
Yes. Exactly right. But that being said, the TV show I'm most excited about right now was Atlanta by Donald Glover. This is an incredible achievement.
Robin season.
Yeah, Robin season. As Richard Wright, I've been transposed to Atlanta in, 2018. Yeah. It's, ultimately, tragic and hilarious. And even, the title, Robin season, I like the fact that it can either be about, a singing Robin or about this season in Atlanta where people begin robbing each other because as Christmas approaches, they need money to buy presents for their families. But he's working at that level of literary depth that you don't see on television that often. He's also a rapper, intriguingly. So if you haven't been watching Atlanta, you should watch it. It's great.
Scott, you're a pop culture guy.
Yeah. Well, in terms of seeing your experience reflected back at you, but maybe for me it's kind of through a convex mirror, is Transparent, which I just feel like really captured the texture of Jewish family life in L.A., and I was totally drawn into it. But actually, I've been kind of more, I just taught a class in the 70s, and we saw Network, where Howard Beale gives the, you know, a monologue, the one after the most famous one, where he's about, turn it off, turn it off, turn off those TVs, you're becoming humanoids. And I feel like there's almost a superabundance of seductive programming now on TV, and it's easy to change one's habits so that at 11 o'clock, instead of picking up a novel and reading that, you can just put on a show that has three seasons, and it's just you're gonna probably stay awake longer watching the TV show and binge it. And I feel like actually I'm trying to not be seduced by that superabundance, because I do feel like there's a gratification I get from being in the pages of a novel or a biography, what have you, that to me is more deeply fulfilling. And I've started to somehow question how TV fulfills my appetites. So I love noir, and there's so much amazing, like Italian noir, Scandinavian noir, I mean, all these great detective shows, and at a certain point you realize, like, why am I watching another show about a serial killer who, you know, takes apart, you know, or does some horrible things to women's bodies.
We all want to know that.
I mean, but at some point you just flip it off and you decide, I'm going to tell a different story. I mean, I think this is something that Joyce brought up at the very beginning of the panel. It's like, there are many different kinds of stories we can tell ourselves, and sometimes you need to switch the story, like switching the channel. And that, I think, could be a very deliberate move you make to change your life.
So we got through that whole series of answers, and nobody mentioned Cabernet Sauvignon for while watching TV, or vodka. So that's interesting. And with me, for instance, everybody would always ask after, well, it's all about the Sopranos, or all about the Honeymooners, for that matter. So it's great that we have different kind of stories here. So let's go back to a less serious subject, and that is the public role of the author. So how has that changed in your guys' minds these days, with the Amazon industrial complex, with print on demand, with self-publishing, with, I mean, how has the public role of the author changed? Maybe the corollary question, how has the role of the audience changed with the result of these new forms of delivery of stories?
Well, I can speak sort of briefly. I think there's a very public voice, and it is always a small private voice. The great poets of the 19th century were Walt Whitman and Emily Dickinson, and one was extremely public, and he saw himself as a sort of exemplar, and he represented all of humankind, basically. Talking about himself as a way of talking about all of us, but he had talked about many, many things, and Walt Whitman was a great poet of egalitarianism and love between people, not necessarily opposite sex, but just sort of a great love, brotherhood, sisterhood, love of animals, love of life. And he was solidly immersed in history. He has very beautiful short lyrics also, but we think of him in these long lines that are very engaging and very incantatory and hypnotic. But then Emily Dickinson was very private. I'm not saying that one is masculine, one is feminine. It sort of seems that way, but neither one of them is to be defined by his or her genre, because Whitman had a good deal of the female in him, and Emily Dickinson is very sharp and cerebral, has a good deal of what we might call the masculine. But as it turned out, Emily Dickinson was a very private person. She wrote small poems, small in content or an outline, but very dynamic and universal and deep in content. And so it seems to me that there is a role for the public personality, if that is your extroverted self and you want to get in the scrimmage of life, as D.H. Lawrence said. But if you're not like that, I don't see any reason why you should force yourself, and nobody should criticize you. You want to be very private, have your own poetry, your own private thoughts. You don't want to engage with the politics of the time. I think that's perfectly respectable, and I don't think anyone should tell anyone else what to do. And so there's a role for the quiet, beautiful work of art that just maybe speaks to a very few people, or may, as time goes on, like Emily Dickinson's poetry, which was not published, as you know, during her time, eventually that maybe even outshines the more public work.
Public role of the author these days, if any? Is it different?
Well, I can speak to something, thinking as a teacher, something that I've observed and that's been actually documented by this very interesting study. I think it's called the Stanford Writing Study. They looked at Stanford students and how they thought about their own writing. And I've noticed this change as well in my 15 plus years as a teacher, is that it used to be you would give students an assignment and they were writing it for you. You know, you read it, you graded it, it's done. And that seemed more and more dead as a way of understanding writing. That the students these days, they want to write for a certain audience. Writing that is only going to be filed away, you know, for a grade seems much less vital to them. And I think of the Stanford study, they talk about kairos, this idea like writing. This idea that you style yourself differently while writing for different audiences, and that the younger generation, I think, is very good at this. They understand when you're texting one person, you have a different voice than when you're, you know, composing an email to this other person. And so I think that these are people who are not necessarily authors yet, but I think people already have a sense more that like writing exists to do something in the world, to activate possibilities in the world. And that I think is generally a very good thing.
So our poetry students, tend to read poems online. They don't tend to buy books. They have a different connection to the text. Is that a good thing? Is that a complicated thing? Is it inevitable and we'll all live with it? And it works to our advantage ultimately?
I think it's a bad thing if you want poets to continue to exist. Yeah. And to
so that's a no.
to put food on the table and a roof over their head. I think that of all the wondrous things that technology gives us, the depreciation in value of cultural creation, I think, is a real hazard. That when you can consume everything for free, what you consume no longer has any value. And I think that's incredibly frightening, thinking down the line in terms of it's not a sustainable model of artistic practice, I think.
To add another perspective to that, because I think as somebody who is still in the early stages of my career and still hustling, I feel that devaluation really strongly. And that people aren't willing to pay for writing, you know, as they were in the past. But also, I think as somebody who's who is active on Twitter or uses Instagram, uses Facebook and Tumblr and stuff like that, there is a great pleasure in being a reader or a kind of a viewer in this age. In that, Twitter and the internet have allowed ways of engaging with culture and art that simply weren't possible before. Roland Barthes, he makes the distinction between the writerly text and the readerly text, with the writerly text being that which allows a writer to impose an idea or an experience on his or their audience, and the readerly text being that which allows the reader to kind of wander through the text, right, and construct their own, not narrative, but kind of put together a narrative via actual effort, as opposed to being given a narrative, and I always feel like that's what Twitter does. You're being handed poems, maybe unmoored from a single text, and the poet is not being paid for your experience of reading that poem. But there's something about reading that poem while you have another tab open to a music video, and another tab open to maybe Atlanta, and then another tab open to some kind of Tumblr feed that you find really intriguing. That it creates an aesthetic experience that simply wasn't possible before the internet. and kind of like redounds to different ways of creating art as well. So it hurts us, but also I think it like vastly expands what's possible in terms of like just creating art and experiencing art, just to protect Silicon Valley. They need protection.
It needs a lot of protection. So not to go all Oprah here, but well, because Oprah's got her hands full about to run the country, and somehow some coalition, Oprah, Parkland High School students, and Stormy Daniels, maybe we can save the country. So we've been talking about being a writer or writing or doing the work of writing. And I'm wondering, maybe you've had conversations the way I've had with former students who say they want to be writers. Now, I've never met anybody who's ever taken any advice about love or writing, but maybe you have. And I wonder, what is your response to some younger person or older person, for that matter, who comes to you and says, I really want to write. This is my vocation. How do you respond to that?
I think it's very rare that someone who comes with such a raw appeal, it may usually be a young person who is already writing, who's been taking courses, and so there's just sort of a gradual feeling. But I would never presume to predict the future for anyone. Writing is a difficult life. It may be very pleasurable to write, but to have a career, I think, is fraught with much anxiety. We have Anthony Mara on this panel, who represents, I must say, 0.0001% of the young writers of his generation, because it isn't at all easy to have a life, to make a life, to continue. My friend Paul Auster said, he sort of glanced around like the other day, and he saw that virtually everyone who'd started off with him, and maybe in college or graduate school, who were writing and even beginning to publish, they're virtually all gone. Just a few of us, he said, are sort of trudging along that road now. He said, Joyce, you're one of them. And it was sort of a chilling thing, because I do remember all the very talented and idealistic and hopeful young people when I was young who just sort of maybe published a little bit or a book or two, and then they kind of fade out. It's not that they failed exactly, but it's a hard life.
I've been getting that question a lot in the last month, because I'm doing this like mentorship fellowship at Cal right now, and a lot of my students are their English majors, and they want to be writers in the future, and they're just like, how do I actually make that happen at all, considering that they're like, people don't pay and there are very few platforms for writing. And my advice is always go to grad school. get your MFA or go to a PhD program. and just like write when you have like the security and shelter and time and intellectual company that grad school supplies. It's not a perfect solution, but like, that kind of institutional patronage is crucial. It's been crucial for me.
It's funny to me to hear you say that, because my students come to me and they want to go to grad school. I say, don't go to grad school. But maybe that's the one little escape clause, right? The loophole is like, if you just want to be a writer, you're not thinking that actually I'm going to get a job teaching with a PhD, because unfortunately we're not supporting public higher education as we once did. But I think that would make sense, that you're thinking about it. I mean, I think that is actually the best way to go to grad school, is think, okay, the fellowship package is like the most elaborate first book contract I could ever get, with all these crazy stipulations about all these other things I need to write along with that first book. And then meanwhile, you're gonna do some other writing along it and be living basically on the edge of poverty the whole time.
And then you're remaindered as a graduate student at some point.
Can I ask a question of a biographer? I would think that of all the genres, biography is really fraught with a lot of pitfalls, because it means investing your time in years of research, and then hoping at the end, it could be 5, 6, 7, 8 years, and then hoping that will first of all be published, and then, you know, do well.
Oh, this is why I have not, when people ask me what's my next book, I'm like, well, I mean, there's so many pitfalls along the way, because you have to deal with estates. I mean, the first event I did for my Richard Pryor book was a panel at the CUNY Center for Biography with Gary Giddens, who's written some beautiful books on Bing Crosby and jazz figures. And the other person on the panel was Mark Whitaker, who had just published a biography of Bill Cosby. Oh. He spent many years of his life writing this.
Oh my gosh.
yeah. One of the things is that, you know, he was, I felt for Mark Whitaker because he talked about, he was from a biracial family. He didn't really know his black father, didn't have much of a relationship with him, if I'm getting the story right. And so he was living, I think, in upstate Massachusetts with this white mother growing up in the 80s. And Bill Cosby was kind of a surrogate father figure through the Cosby Show. Then he became a very wonderful journalist and did all these things. And he was going to write the biography of Bill Cosby. But because Bill Cosby was living, there were certain conditions if he wanted to enter, you know, into the Cosby Citadel and get access to friends to hear basic stories about Bill Cosby's life. So he wrote a biography that had some strings attached. And I think this was the last public event he did about the Bill Cosby biography because, you know, the Hannibal Buress was circulated around that time. And, you know, the book now just cannot stand. So it's all to say, this is one reason biographers, you know, it's often better to choose people who have died. It allows people to talk much more freely about that person. And that person can't sue you. This is really important. Anyway, it is difficult. And I think that I feel for any biographer who invests so much time in the life of somebody else to try to kind of lovingly recreate, or lovingly or eventually oftentimes full of so many mixed ambivalent emotions, try to recreate that life.
There have been a number of biographers who try to write about Sylvia Plath. Hmm. I know one or two of them, and it's a great subject, but just fraught with so much difficulty because of the estate. She's dead, but the estate lives on.
Well, I think that we have some time for a few questions or comments.
If you have a question, please come up to this blue line right here on the floor.
It sounds imposing, but it really isn't. Chicken.
Oops.
Maybe it is a little bit.
Maybe it is a little bit.
But it's okay.
Okay, great.
Questions, comments? Here we go. Yeah.
And if you can't come up to the mic for any reason, just raise your hand and someone will come to you.
Wait, let me go a second.
I've got the vapors. Yes, I would love you to comment on Audible books. Audiobooks.
Oh.
I'm finding that as my eyes age, I really like the Audible template, but also I'm relating to the story differently than if I were to read it. And now I want to go back and reread Joyce Carol Oates' books from about 20, 30 years ago, because if they were read to me, they'd be much more graphic and perverse than perhaps when I first read them as a 20-something-year-old. But perhaps you could fill us in about what direction this is taking literature, and is this a new frontier?
Of course, books like have always had a performative dimension. Charles Dickens, hugely popular. He was the Mick Jagger of his day.
Yes.
So what about the audio performance or types of performance when it comes to your work?
I love audiobooks. I always have a couple going on. This is maybe after you know the reading or the binge watching at night. I always go to sleep listening to an audiobook. And it's this very soothing. I feel like I'm a kid again, sort of being read a bedtime story. And there's something that you know, even you know, they're almost all people with English accents who sound nothing like my Minnesotan mom. But there's something about the experience that really draws me back to that that sense of just being lulled by storytelling. That I find missing in other forms of my engagement with literature. And I think it also it kind of offers up this opportunity for almost you know, like an old radio drama, mm-hmm. where the performance aspect really comes to the fore. I would, I haven't, but I would think that listening to Shakespeare, or to, you know, to plays, might be a sort of more expansive experience than simply reading it on the page. So I think they're terrific.
Yeah. And did you want to say something?
I just wanted to put, I mean, I actually use audiobooks in my teaching of literature because I find that it allows students often to engage with the story in ways that's harder otherwise. One incredible audiobook that you really must all download is The Invisible Man by Ralph Ellison, performed by Joe Morton, the actor. It's just amazing. And there's these scenes in Invisible Man that have like 10 different characters, and he is bringing them all to life. And so a scene that's almost chaotic on the page becomes just, like you're saying, just vivid drama. I think also of another incredible audiobook is by Prodigy, the late rapper from Mobb Deep. And I think there are ways that in certain audiobooks, especially like, you know, if it's a memoir written, told by the recited by the author, you really get a sense of the grain of the voice. I mean, it adds a whole other dimension to the experience. So I really think it's so wonderful that we have so many great performers of audiobooks.
Not to mention that we need to be more sensitive to learning differences and bypass strategies when it comes to students who are challenged by, have executive function challenge.
Or dyslexia. I mean.
Or dyslexia, yeah. Another question? There's a big light in my eye, so I can't see you. Sorry. There you are.
Oh, okay. So I'm wondering, in our information age, there seems to be tons of stories that we can orient ourselves around, or like there's tons of religions and we just have a lot of stories that we can attach to ourselves, and it seems that a lot of these stories, or there's so many of them that it can be almost arbitrary which ones we live by. So I'm wondering how can we find a story for ourselves? How can there's just so many, it mm-hmm. seems out there, that different ideologies. So how can we find one that's right or
Mm-hmm. So you're looking for some guidance about where to look inside yourself and outside yourself for those stories that will give you meaning, give you direction.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Well, several answers occurs to me, but read a lot. That would be one thing, which I'm sure you do. And I would say, since nobody else is talking, I would say read. Where you find yourself most challenged and where you find yourself, where you have a little difficulty getting through. I mean, some of the most interesting reading experiences for me have been with writers whom I couldn't read the first time or first 10 times through.
I'll quote Toni Morrison. She said, "If you can't find the book that you want to read, you must write it yourself."
That's true. That's great.
Well, I actually brought a quote from Rebecca Solnit, who's speaking later. Everybody should go see her. And she's in this amazing book, Far Away Nearby. She writes, "We think we tell stories, but stories often tell us to love or to hate, to see or to be blind. Often, too often, stories saddle us, ride us, whip us onward, tell us what to do, and we do it without questioning. The task of learning to be free requires learning to hear them, to question them, to pause and hear silence, to name them, and then to become the storyteller."
That's Toni Morrison's. Yeah. So thank you for your question. I hope that was helpful. Is there another question?
Hello.
So
I read an article a couple of months ago, I think, by Vietu Thanh Nguyen in the New York Times, and he was saying that one of the basic rules about writing is like show, don't tell, right? And in this article, he said, well, why, if you come from a culture that it's basically telling and not showing, and that stayed with me because I'm from Brazil and I come from a culture that people tell and don't show that much. And I'm writing here, and all the rules about writing helped me a lot, but my culture is different. And I just would like you to tell what you think about that.
Show versus tell. Rules for writing. How do we approach rules for writing? I'm asking for a friend.
I'll just say that there's a great book by Philip Lope called To Show and To Tell, which is about, I use it for teaching nonfiction. It's specifically about creative nonfiction and how we should not denigrate the telling part as well as the showing, that they work very well in sync or in conjunction with one another.
Yes, I think this is kind of balanced, the pace of the narrative. Some writers have a lot of expository material and they tell a good deal, but they tell it so beautifully that we want to read it. Thomas Hardy, for instance, or Dickens, Faulkner. Hemingway doesn't have that. There's almost no expository material, and Hemingway just moves smoothly along in the present tense. It's basically the sort of writing that is dramatizing and showing Hemingway's way of presenting the material. He's showing you what it is, what the scene is, but he's not telling what to think about it. But there's another kind of narration that frankly does kind of tell you, and I think both are very valuable.
So where do you guys put Pynchon here on that spectrum? Is he showing or telling? I'd like to know, really.
Well, I think he's telling because it's all voice. Okay. It's performative. It's quite unique.
It strikes me that that like dictum to show, not tell, like depends on the kind of consensus about like what kinds of details one shows, when put in front of the reader constitute a story, which means that you have to have some kind of consensus like among a readerly audience about what should be shown, right? And that works if you're I think a white writer or a writer who like went through an MFA program. You know, if you read Friends and he's really into showing, if you can recognize the kind of cultural signals he's giving off, then that's a story for you. I read Friends and I don't recognize anything right. In those novels that like constitutes a story to me. Right. And so like I think like Joyce said, sometimes when you're telling a story from a marginalized or a different background, a telling is necessary.
Did we get another question? Have time for a few more?
Yeah, we have three people in line, so that's okay.
We'll stay forever.
Okay.
Hello. I was curious if you had any advice.
I'm sorry, I can't hear you.
Oh, sorry about that. I was curious if you had any advice for people who are trying to break into the literary journals to build a name for themselves as opposed to the online only. If that makes any sense, I hope.
Well, I mean, they're wonderful. Ishmael works for Ziziva magazine, terrific San Francisco national publication that I'm very familiar with. There are booths everywhere throughout the festival where magazines are featured. And I would say, take a look at the magazines. Find the place where, you know, find the stories and the poems that resonate for you, and that's a good place to seek publication.
I would also say that something I've learned since getting involved with Ziziva is that, like, since I'm actually reading what gets submitted to the journal, so few things that get submitted actually get published in the journal, or, like, even make it to the editors. Going to parties, like, I think is, like, a much better strategy than submitting. Like, literally, like, going to parties, meeting people, meeting editors and other writers, making connections, like, that's what's worked for me, and I think that's what's working for a lot of, like, young, emerging writers. I feel like the literary journal submission thing is kind of a trap. I don't know.
So you didn't come here for social tips, but there you go. Okay, we have time for a couple more, maybe?
Yeah, I heard last question.
Yeah.
Hi, this is for you, Joyce. Your ability to get into characters' brains amazes me. And on top of that, your characters get into my brain, and they stay, and they live there. I think about people that I've read in your books a lot, and I've read a lot of books, but your characters live in my brain. It's amazing. So my question is, do you have a muse? How do you do this superhuman feat?
Well, thank you for your remark. I don't think of it as superhuman. I spend a lot of time thinking about the characters and sort of inhabiting them. I like to go for long walks or even running and just sort of thinking about the work, not necessarily thinking about the writing of it, but more like thinking of the actual people. And they start to live for me for quite a while before I write about them. So it's like an aura or a feeling of almost like of identification. Thank you.
Well, so that's been our panel about how stories make the world. I think we've completely covered that subject.
I think we have time for one more question.
One more question here. Yeah.
All right. I thought that we were done. Okay.
Thank you. I promise to be brief. I just wanted to ask, and I've been dying to ask this question for like 5 years, because I know Joyce Carol Oates has the work with the World Science Festival, and I know Ishmael was talking about his technology and this idea of science and how science may invade your work, and I wanted to hear more about that. So,
the question was about science and literature? So, well, it's such a complicated question. Probably in the last 8 years or so, I've been much more aware of the world of science. I've been reading a lot of books of science and biographies and thinking about the world not so much from my earlier perspective, the writerly perspective, but rather more like an objective. Science is based upon an evolution of ideas, and so there's always a drama and excitement of new ideas and the world being transformed. So, definitely, I've actually written about scientists, which I would not have done before.
And we both admire Version Control, which is a terrific novel.
Oh, yes.
That's a terrific novel.
Dexter Palmer.
About that very subject.
He's an unclassifiable writer, isn't he?
Yeah.
I think that you asked sort of how technology invades your work. And I think that technology, aside from sort of the discussion of it in broader sort of like social or cultural contexts, just purely as a nuts and bolts narrative issue, it presents a lot of hurdles for writers. For instance, cell phones. Having a cell phone in a novel, having two cell phones in a novel, basically reduces a lot of dramatic choices, because as soon as you have characters who can text each other or call each other, or who, as soon as everybody in a fictional world knows where everybody else is, you lose a lot of opportunities for creating dramatic obstacles. Think of how many books would have been solved on the first page if one character could just call another.
I solved that problem by having the phone just run out of power.
I'm going to steal that trick from you.
So I want to acknowledge again UC Berkeley Arts and Design, the Simpson Family Literary Project. Thank you all for coming. We have authors' books in the lobby, and my very distinguished panel, Scott Saul, Ishmael Muhammad, Anthony Mara, and Joyce Carol Oates. Thank you. Have a wonderful day.
We hope you enjoyed this podcast from the 2018 Bay Area Book Festival. For more podcasts, please go to www.baybookfest.org.